Good day. Welcome to UCT Law at Work's series of podcasts. I'm your host, Irena Wasserfall. Today we'll be chatting with Dr. Merrill Duplessis of the Witt School of Law about the safety of workers returning to work during lockdown or after lockdown is lifted. Welcome, Merrill. Would you like to tell us a little bit about your research interests at WITS and what exactly it is that you do there?
Hi, Irena. Thanks for having me. I am a senior lecturer at the WITS School of Law. My research basically focuses on labor and social security issues and also where those two aspects intersect. So I basically look at the social and economic security of workers. So an element of that would be making sure that workers are healthy and safe at work, and then also what happens when they are not. So if they contract occupational diseases or they have injuries at work, how do we as a society respond to that? Are we distributing the risks of that happening fairly? And so my research really focuses on, in the last few years, I focused on what one could term new risks, I suppose, in the sense that I look at things like psychosocial conditions that result from, things like depression or conditions that result from stress, work stress. And so my research has really focused on those risks that are generally overlooked. And I think that with COVID-19, which is what we will be chatting about today, I don't think it's a risk that many people would have foreseen. So it's of particular interest to me. Yeah.
That's fantastic. That's very interesting, Merrill. Thank you very much for chatting to us today. We really appreciate it. I'm sure that you'll agree that over the last 2 months or so, we've had an incredible shock to our system. We would never have imagined that this year we'd be forced to be closing businesses entirely, working remotely, social distancing ourselves, and even being placed under curfew.
Yeah.
As the stages of lockdown are inevitably reduced to a space where we are allowed to go on with our business, I thought it would be a good thing for workers to know what their rights are to be kept safe in the workplace by their employers, and for employers perhaps to know what the expectations on them are to keep their employees safe. So bearing that in mind, who could be expected to work? Obviously, because this is going to be in a state of flux for the future.
I just want to comment on something that you said initially, and the fact that, we have been talking, I think when people think about occupational health and safety, it's not something that really is part of sort of mainstream public discourse. You know, it's really only when there's been a disaster. And examples would be in the mines when you have a high number of deaths or persistent problems. But I think occupational health and safety has always been sort of separated from public health. And Judge Van Niekerk, in a recent judgment on COVID-19 in mines, have specifically addressed that, where he says that you cannot separate this risk. You know, you can't keep it in the workplace. It's a public health risk. And I think what COVID-19 has done is that it's made us painfully aware of how a public health risk comes into the workplace and gets taken from the workplace back into the general public, and how you actually can't separate those two aspects of health, which I think might not be the worst thing to happen. Having a real understanding of those relationships. I think that it's been scary for many workers, and it still is, having to decide whether you are going to work, knowing the risks, And for many people, the other option is not being employed and not having an income. So those are very difficult sort of trade-offs to have to make. But yeah, with who can be expected to work, we know that that is constantly shifting. And, you know, with the risk-adjusted regulations, we still have, those activities that are deemed essential services. So people working at, you know, supermarkets have been open. More recently, we've now seen that those people involved with e-commerce, so people who worked at financial institutions, banks, they've been working throughout. Obviously, your healthcare workers, they would have been working throughout certain urgent repairs. And as the sort of risk level decreases, we'll see more and more people returning to work. And I think that for them, obviously, the concern would be how do we protect ourselves? So in terms of the personal responsibility that we take, because it's not just their health that would be at risk. Those are people, very often people live with other people. Many times people would be living with people who have pre-existing conditions, who would be particularly vulnerable to the effects of the virus. And they would be living with elderly relatives, for example. So their concern would not just be for their own health, but also for those of family members that they come into contact with, as well as community health at large. Yeah.
It seems like people really are between a rock and a hard place. You know, it's a case of are you eating because you're working, or are you infecting all those loved ones around you? It can be kind of a difficult decision to make.
Yes, and I think also employers are also because many employers who are good citizens would be concerned about the effects of not operating on employees and on jobs, quite frankly. But at the same time, they would also know that if they do have employees coming back into the workplace, they are going to have to ensure that, not just because it's a legal requirement, but also because that's the right thing to do, that it's healthy and it's a safe environment for employees to return to.
Yes. So, Meryl, if we had a look at the Occupational Health and Safety Act, what in an ideal world, well, not actually in an ideal world, but what under normal circumstances would the duties of an employer be in terms of occupational health and safety?
Yeah, so, Irina, the duties would be obviously to employees, but also to members of the public where risks arise from that employer's activities. So it really is a question of employers having to bear those risks that their activities create. And so in terms of the normal duties, even prior to the Occupational Health and Safety Act, so in terms of the South African common law, which is a combination of English and Roman Dutch law, there is an obligation on an employer to ensure as far as possible a healthy and safe working environment. And there are, in terms of the obligations, those are stratified. So there will be absolute obligations or strict obligations where employers will have to ensure that employees are safe. Most of the duties are of a slightly lower order where the employer has to do what is reasonably practicable. So what is reasonable, what can reasonably be expected of an employer given the size of the employer, for example, the resources at their disposal, practically speaking, what is it possible for them to do? And I think we'll get back to that in the context of COVID-19 in a bit. But the fact that most of those duties, so if you look at the regulations regarding health and safety in the context of COVID-19, a lot of those duties are duties that are of the standard where we expect the employer to do what is reasonably practicable.
And that's kind of difficult in this time, because we're talking about it's not like fixing a railing so that employees don't fall down the stairs and hurt themselves. This is dealing with an enemy that we can't see. So this must put the employers in kind of a difficult situation.
Look, I mean, it's also because, I mean, scientifically what we know, I mean, we've had researchers working in countries where we have, where the virus has been present for longer. But I mean, we still don't have clarity on, for example, how long the virus stays in the air for after being released into the air. So there are some researchers who have said that there is an element of it being airborne, whereas initially, you know, there were researchers who said, no, it's really just human-to-human contact. We also know that it stays on certain surfaces and that it stays for longer on some surfaces than others. So those are all, if you look at the sort of assessment of risk that employers are compelled to do, so all employers are expected to assess the risks. These are the kinds of things that one would ideally like to know in order to be able to assess the risks. But,
Sorry for interrupting you. So, for example, I have in my particular unit, I have 8 ladies who work for me, and we are sort of in a very small space where we have the sharing of offices. So practically, what could I do as an employer that would help protect my staff members from COVID, especially in an office environment? Mm. Just as an example, what would your thoughts be on that?
Yeah, I mean, because I know a little bit about the setup at UCT and at universities in general, I think that, well, the first thing is that you would be impacted upon by various sets of regulations. So there'd be the sort of general lockdown, the risk-adjusted regulations. Then there would be the directives issued by the Minister of Higher Education about who can and can't come to work at universities. Then there would be so I think one of the things that I also need to mention is that in terms of the health and safety regulations in the context of COVID that came out a few weeks ago, they are sector specific. They specifically mention the fact that there'll be an assessment of risk for particular sectors, and that there may be directives that come from particular sectors. So I think employers and employees also just have to keep a lookout. Hopefully communication is good, and if there are sector specific directives, that those actually filter through to employers, and that those are abided by. But I think from a practical perspective, what you asked, so if you do the type of work, so you would look at the type of work that you are doing. And if it's possible for you and the 6 colleagues that work with you to work from home, that would obviously be first prize, I think. So if it is possible to actually work from home, if the employer is in a position to provide the equipment and the sort of resources that you will need to be able to do your work, whether that be laptops, whether that be, you know, telephone, cell phone connectivity, and being, you know, making sure that you are able to connect, then one would hope that is done. So I think that it would, and this is also what makes it difficult, because it will vary from one employer to the next, because the minute you have to start accommodating and you have to start doing risk adjustments or adjust for risks,
yes,
there will be very sort of specific elements. So you would take into account the nature of the job. You would take into account the resources of the employer and what they can and can't provide. And you would also take into account the position of your employees, and whether they are able to work meaningfully with what the employer is able to provide. So I think, you know, it's very difficult in the abstract. We can have general principles saying that the employer has to do risk assessments, which they do, and then they have to put in place control measures to ensure that those risks don't eventuate. But a lot of those control measures are sort of public health control measures as well. It's just about making sure that in the work context, it sort of gets subsumed into standard operating procedures, you know. So the hand washing, where possible, making sure that in South Africa, we've talked about 1 meter, but elsewhere, you know, people are actually saying that it should be 2 meters. Making sure that where it's possible, social distance. So with office space, for example, if it is at all possible to separate people, if you're working with skeleton staff, for example, what that might mean is that some space opens up elsewhere, and that you may be able to shift employees so that they are able to do social distancing at work. And then it's the obvious things, you know, making sure hand sanitizers are available, deep cleaning spaces once employees have left and before they come in. And obviously, you know, even within the general regulations, we are now all required to wear a cloth mask. So that's not just an occupational health and safety sort of requirement. But I think in a work context, and particularly certain types of jobs, if you think of people working in mines, for example, there would be specialized personal protective equipment. So those of us who do general work, we probably would stick with the cloth masks, but there would be instances where you would need specialized equipment in certain sectors in order to protect workers better.
So complying with your duties could I'm sorry, there seems to be a bit of a feedback. So complying with your duties in terms of the Occupational Health and Safety Act as an employer can be quite challenging. It might be that you'd have to buy extra equipment. You might have to only work with skeleton staff. So it's quite clear that it's an evolving process, but it is going to be very challenging for employers, especially financially, I would imagine, having to acquire all this equipment to keep your staff safe.
Yeah. No, and I mean, a lot of it will depend on whether organizations have foregrounded health and safety up till now and have therefore budgeted for it. And I'm sorry to say, but there would be many organizations who have not done that. So the budgets would not exist. They should, but they don't. And I think also in terms of the current moment, there would be many businesses who would be fearing for their very existence. And in that context, the impulse would be to cut costs at every turn, whereas this actually requires some outlay in order to protect workers. And I think that tension is not one that is easily resolved, which is why you would need health inspectors to perform their roles. We know from news reports that they have shut down some workplaces for non-compliance. And the reports that have been coming out from the Department of Labor is that there's a very high level of non-compliance by employers. While one can have sympathy for that, I mean, if there isn't a workplace culture, if there wasn't a workplace culture of health and safety, it's certainly not going to miraculously become perfect just because we are in this crisis. You need processes that need to be in place. And if employees aren't used to a culture of health and safety, it's going to be very difficult to amend processes, particularly in a time where the impulse is to produce quicker, make sure that businesses stay or organizations stay profitable and productive. I think that there would be competing sort of impulses there, in the sense that we want workers to be safe, but at the same time, we're also trying to sort of make up for lost time and lost profits.
Yeah, no, that was definitely, because I mean, we've had almost two months now of absolute standstill. So I can imagine there's a lot of catching up to do.
Yeah.
So Meryl, what would you suggest are workplace structures that need to be created or utilized to ensure health and safety in the workplace?
Look, Irina, in terms of the Occupational Health and Safety Act, there are certain bigger employers. I think it's if you have more than 500 employees, you need to have, I think it's smaller as well. The 500 employees, you actually have to produce a written risk assessment report to the Department of Labor with in terms of the structures at work. Employers are, and there are exceptions, so small, medium, and micro enterprises don't have to have workplace health and safety committees. But in terms of the Occupational Health and Safety Act, employers do have to create a health and safety committee at work, where employees, and it acts as a forum where management and employees can discuss risks. It's important in terms of assessing what the risks are, but also consistently monitoring whether the control measures to mitigate against those risks, whether those control measures are working, and if they are not working, being responsive, hearing what employees' experiences are, and in order to ensure that adjustments can be made. And particularly with COVID-19, it's relatively new. It would be relatively new in workplaces to have to control that for that risk. So there'll have to be constant communication, and employees would have to give their input in terms of what is workable and what is not, in order to ensure that everyone stays safe. So I think the health and safety committees, and I think the workplace forums generally that exist within the workplace, it's very important that those work well, and that there's open and transparent communication between everyone who would be affected. And that basically would be everyone, from management to employers at the lowest income, employees at the lowest income levels.
So if these workplace committees have discussed the whole situation with COVID-19, with management, and there's been interaction between them. And the employer hasn't put in place the measures needed to protect me. What are my rights as an employee?
Look, I think generally in terms of the Occupational Health and Safety Act, as an employee, you have the right to protect your health. So you can be asked to be moved to doing something different. In extreme situations, you can lodge a grievance saying that, look, I'm not willing to comply with this work request. So I think from the Occupational Health and Safety Act, it's quite clear that employers do have a right to protect their own health. And in fact, they have an obligation to do so. And I think what is important in the context of COVID-19 is that it's not an individualized risk. So if you place one employee at risk, the repercussions are potentially very dire, not just for that particular employee. And I think that makes it different from a lot of other occupational health and safety risks. The fact that there is this knock-on effect, which is why we have seen employees protesting. Employees have protested saying that their employers are not providing a safe and healthy working environment and that they are refusing to work in those conditions. So we've seen employees at supermarkets striking because they are saying that it's not possible for them to work in an environment that is healthy and safe.
Yes. And I can imagine that the employer would have to also, I mean, there's new ways of doing things. So the employer must put proper training in place too, in respect of, for example, protective equipment, how to use it properly and safely so as not to cause infection to others.
Yes. And I think that, and this is where, even if you look at the not just the occupational health and safety measures, so some of the workers that are most at risk are people who would be who would come into contact with the general public. So it would be cashiers at supermarkets, pharmacists at retail pharmacies. Those employees would come into, so there would be no way of, it's members of the general public who come into their workplace. And I think that in those environments, it's important. So if you've been to a supermarket recently, I'm glad to see now there are hand sanitizers as you enter, sanitizing the trolleys before you enter the supermarket. In some ways, you know, with some of the, to give you an example, some of those hand sanitizers still require you to use your own hand in order to dispense the sanitizer. Yes. That's not great. And unfortunately, I've seen many retail organizations use those. Then there are others where you actually use your foot to dispense the sanitizer. So it's those little things in terms of, you know, sort of preventing contamination and cross-contamination that will become important.
I've noticed too that, for example, at supermarkets, some of them have someone standing there and they are the ones dispensing the sanitizer so that you don't have to touch it at all. You just hold out your hands. And that seems like a good practical example of how to do it.
Yes.
Okay, so, sorry, Meryl, I interrupted you.
No, that's fine.
Okay. I just wanted to ask, if I as an employee became ill from COVID-19, do you think that that would be handled as an injury on duty in terms of the Occupational Health and Safety Act?
Yeah, so in generalized, I should just preface what we have said now would apply to general workers, but would exclude mine workers because they have the Mine Health and Safety Act that would apply to them, as opposed to the Occupational Health and Safety Act. And also, even in terms of their compensation legislation, that's different to the legislation that would apply to other workers. So with compensation for what we can loosely describe as general workers, it would be the Compensation for Occupational Injuries and Diseases Act that would apply. And there also has been a directive on COVID-19 and compensation for occupational injuries and diseases. So it would seem that COVID-19 would be treated as an occupational disease. And I think it's important for me to explain that there is a difference between an occupational injury and an occupational disease in terms of the Act. And we're talking about goiter now. And with an occupational disease, you don't have to prove an accident defined in the Act, which actually does matter because very often it would be difficult, particularly with delayed onset conditions. You won't be able to point to a particular incident that caused you to fall ill. So that's one positive of it being regarded as an occupational disease. So what would happen is that you would have to prove that you have come into contact with someone who was diagnosed as having contracted the virus. They look at potential travel histories of people that you may have come into contact with, and they also look at whether you are in a high risk, medium risk, or low risk occupation. So they are trying to sort of combat the difficulty of proving when exactly you contracted the virus. However, the general requirement of having to prove that a condition arose in the scope of your employment, that traditionally has been difficult. And I think with COVID-19, I fear similar difficulties. But in terms of the compensation, if you do manage to prove an occupational cause, so in terms of the compensation legislation, you don't have to prove that your employer was negligent. So the no-fault scheme. But you would have to prove a work cause, so the sort of employment origins of your condition, which can be problematic. But then in terms of compensation, you can either, for most people, it would be temporary disablement that they would claim for. I think we when I've chatted to people, one of the fears is that there may be long-term consequences, health consequences for employees, even after they test negative for the virus. So there may be respiratory repercussions that arise from, and it's not exactly clear whether the regulator or the directive does, in theory, provide for permanent disablement. But in practice, one can foresee that there may be difficulties in terms of proving those causal links. And yeah, there are ways of dealing with it, but I think for now we'll just deal with the directives and the legal provisions as they stand.
Yes, because it seems that this virus has a lot of different side effects. You know, in some people, I was listening to the radio yesterday, and there was a nurse that had written a letter to the radio station explaining some of the various things that happen to people that have had COVID, and it could be anything from kidney infections to lung failure to heart problems. So it's going to be very difficult to contain, or not contain, but to ascertain rather whether your long-term effect resulted was formed as a result of COVID-19. Mm-hmm. I think there's going to be some interesting things in the future when it comes to these kind of claims to deal with.
Yes, I mean, I think that, you know, even with lung diseases, for example, that arise because someone worked with benzene, let's say you worked at a dry cleaners.
Yes.
You know, if that same person smokes, for example,
yes,
and there's deterioration in their lungs, you know, there could be an awful lot of evidence that would have to be led on what was the primary cause of the person's lung condition. So I think with COVID-19, because it's a novel virus, a lot of this research has not been done. Medically, there are things that we don't know yet, and scientifically we don't know yet. And I've written on this before, where I have asked who should actually bear the risk of us not knowing. Should it be the poor employee who financially is in a worse off position, or should it be the employer whose activities create those risks? And when I say the employer, it's not even the employer directly, because what a compensation system does is it insures the employer against having to pay for all of the damage that their activities can do. So in many respects, you know, I have argued, and other people have argued, that perhaps that system, even if you just shift, well, at the very least, you should shift evidentiary burdens in terms of who has to prove what. But I think ultimately also in terms of, because in terms of our common law, the general rule is that the risk lies where it falls. And I'm saying from a policy perspective, and I would argue from a constitutional perspective, we cannot be that blasé about employees' health and about the financial consequences. And I have argued that actually, no, the risk mustn't lie where it falls. The risk must be attributed, and the risk must be borne by those who are better placed to combat that risk, and those who benefit from the creation of that risk. And that would include employers. They would be top of the list. They benefit from the creation of the risk. So they should bear some responsibility when the risk eventuates. Yeah.
So if you swung it around and looked at the employees, what would happen if I am infected with COVID, but because of the no work, no pay rule, I go to work while I'm infected and I end up infecting half the factory, for example? What would be done about me? Because surely I've been lax in my duty to make sure that everybody else around me is also safe by my actions.
No, and I mean that is a real concern. There are potentially criminal consequences if you knowingly infect others with the virus. In terms of the directives, And in terms of the common law, you could also face civil damages. You may also have to pay civil damages if you knowingly infect others with the virus. And this is where I think because the health and safety regulations clearly state that if you are sick, your employer is expected, and this is where that interconnectedness becomes clear, Irina, because you, in terms of Section 22 of the Basic Conditions of Employment Act, you are entitled to sick leave. You shouldn't be in a position where it's no work, no pay.
Yes.
But we know practically that is not what is happening. Employers are instituting no work, no pay rules in contravention of the Basic Conditions of Employment Act. And that puts employees in a very difficult situation. And here, yes, I think employers also should face the risk of criminal and civil liability if they place employees in a position where they are risking their own health and the health of their colleagues as well as the general public if they come into contact with members of the public. But yes, you definitely could face criminal consequences.
It's definitely very interesting times, and there's going to be a lot of developments, I would imagine, as we go into the future dealing with this particular pandemic. And no doubt it's going to set the stage for many other disaster management situations that we will face in the future.
Yes, Irina, just in terms of, I don't think that this is a short-term, even when lockdown is lifted, I think that we've seen other countries talking about new infections after they've managed to curb, so rebound and knock on infections, and so I think that this is something that is going to be with us for a considerable time, and that we would be well placed to ensure, employers would be well placed to ensure that for the medium term, the short to medium term, they sort out those risk assessment processes and they put in place those control measures so that it actually becomes a workplace culture, something that is done, as second nature.
Yes.
And something that becomes part of how production is taking place or how services are delivered. Yeah.
Yes, because at the moment we're being very reactive, and if what you say is true and people start implementing it, then it will be preventative measures.
Yes.
And as a culture.
Yes.
In the workplace. Meryl, thank you. It's been fascinating speaking to you. Have you got any parting thoughts for us?
No, I just wish everyone, a healthy and safe work life. And I wish employees weren't put in a position where they have to make these difficult choices. But if they do, they do have a right to protect their own health, and not just their own health, but the health of their loved ones. And I think that also for employees, collective action can often achieve more than individualized grievances. So work through those health and safety committees, work through your unions, and hopefully, collectively we can find ways of making sure that where economic activity continues, it's done in a way that doesn't cost people their health and in some instances their lives.
Thank you, Meryl. Thanks very much for being with us, and I wish you well too.
Thank you very much. Thanks for having me, Irina.